This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. The debate around critical race theory among parents and educators has been a hot topic for some across the country and here in Indiana. Today, we hope to learn and understand more about critical race theory, why it's been on the minds of lawmakers and parents, and what it means for schools and educators in the state. With us now is Eric Weddle, managing editor for WFYI's Education Desk. Here to help us find out what's been going on in Indiana schools and how school leaders are addressing this issue. Welcome to the program, Eric.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Let's start with learning more about this debate on critical race theory. How long has this been going on in Indiana, or is this something totally new?
Yeah, this is something new. I mean, Indiana has been the focus of debates on classroom teaching and curriculum in the past, but the debate right now on how to teach, you know, race and racism in public schools and initiatives around inclusion and diversity is something new.
Mm-hmm. And do you know when or how this all began here in Indiana in particular?
Yeah. I mean, I can't like pinpoint where we first saw this issue erupt into the public in Indiana. And there are school districts and counties where it's become a focus, such as Hamilton County, north of Indianapolis. But before this debate came here, you know, it was playing out in other states on cable news and talk radio. And, you know, we've seen about 20 states so far have introduced bills that would restrict how teachers discuss racism, raise controversial issues in the classroom. And eight states and mostly Republican state houses, you know, have passed bills so far this year. There's the news site Education Week, you know, reported that, you know, critical race theory, you know, the focus on that began about a year ago with some conservative groups, you know, in wake of the social justice protest that we saw. And then that kind of caught the attention of President Trump, who signed an executive order about it that has since been repealed by President Biden. But some of that language, you know, ended up in these bills that we're seeing. And so as that's played out, you know, it's made its way here into Indiana.
Yeah, I was wondering if any of this was tied to the social justice movements, because it seemed like there were other types of bills that started to get passed around that time, like anti-protest and stuff like that. So is this kind of following in that same line?
I mean, it seems to be. I mean, from what, you know, some of the research I've done and what I've read, other, you know, like I mentioned, Education Week, since been great reporting on the background on this and how it's kind of come, you know, into play. You know, it seems like it's kind of followed last summer. There's been just an increase in the interest in different kinds of special interest groups and then groups who are lobbying lawmakers to pass bills around different types of topics that are being discussed in schools.
And what are some of the things that you're hearing, common concerns from parents when it comes to critical race theory being taught in Indiana schools, if there are any concerns?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you'll maybe discuss this later, you know, in the show, but I think it's clear to say, you know, critical race theory, you know, for what it is, that's not really, I don't think, what we're seeing people protest in Indiana. You know, critical race theory is more of an academic framework to discuss and study how people of color have been impacted by different types of perceptions on race, inequity, structural racism. So I think it's clear to say this is also a political battle, right? So critical race theory, from my reporting and from what I've seen talking to people on the ground, is it's kind of become a catch-all phrase for all types of issues, you know, by opponents, and also, you know, for discussions about diversity and inclusion. And so the parents I've spoken to, you know, told me that they kind of believe that there's a discussion around current events in the classroom, like the election that we just went through, Black Lives Matter movement, has just kind of gone too far. And they believe teachers are injecting too much of their beliefs on these issues into the classroom, you know, and they're talking about history and history of racism in a way that they don't either agree with or think that should be, you know, presented in that way to their children. And, you know, from that, you know, you hear the parents, they want to have like more control of what's being taught in the classroom now. And, you know, even the state-funded public schools they attend, they want to have more control over what's happening. And I've talked to some parents, you know, who say they want to even opt their kids out of some classes or some class times, you know, if they aren't clear what will be discussed on these topics.
I wonder if some of the discomfort from parents comes from the fact that, like, so many of us who've grown up never had really critical conversations about these topics. You know, you learn the basics, but when you get into it, it's a lot deeper. It's a lot more painful to understand.
Yeah, I mean, in my experience the past few years in the classroom, I think teachers have actually really embraced this time that we're going through, just because it's kind of social media, the interaction everyone has, I think they're finding students more engaged on all topics and in all manners, and it's creating a lot richer conversations and teaching and learning in the classroom.
Sure. And how do educators feel about this? I mean, it affects definitely the way that they're going to structure their curriculum.
Yeah, I mean, in states, you know, where laws have passed, you know, you hear teachers are worried about, you know, how their teaching is going to be impacted. You know, who's going to decide what they can or not can or cannot say or teach in class based on the laws of their state? You know, how do you discuss current events when it is? I mean, right now, so much is divisive in general. You know, you look online, look on TV, just the discourse from your local city council, you know, up to the you know, to Washington, D.C. is divisive. So I think you're seeing a lot of reporting around teachers are just wondering, like, what's it going to look like when I go back to school? And these laws are brand new. And they don't want to get in trouble. They don't want to become like a viral moment. You know, I think there's a lot of concern among educators right now.
Have you heard from educators that feel passionate one way or the other about this topic?
I mean, I think in Indiana, I mean, it's more so for people just seeing what's going to happen here. You know, I mean, we don't have any laws being passed here. I know there's lawmakers that have interested in that. There's been some comments made, but I think it'll kind of depend what happens here. But I think they're already starting to have those same concerns I just mentioned.
Right, right. And when it comes to school board meetings, have you seen any movement on this, any discussion there?
Well, you know, last week recently, you know, but the state board school board meeting. And I think a lot of people expected that to come to that meeting. It did not. There was no public comment there or really any comment by anyone at the board who I don't really believe wants to get into this debate right now. But local school boards, yes. I mean, you know, this spring across Hamilton County, we've seen parents speaking out during school board meetings, sometimes for hours, at Carmel Clay Schools, Noblesville Schools, Hamilton Southeastern, Westfield Washington Schools. And these dual school districts have faced accusations, you know, of teaching critical race theory, of also doing other things that related to social emotional learning, which has become kind of a catchphrase as well for people who are opposed to CRT. So that right now is kind of playing out in certain school districts, you know, at that level, because, you know, the school board is kind of the one, you know, who decides what's being taught, the curriculum and so forth. So you are seeing that happen there.
Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. We're speaking with Eric Weddle, managing editor for WFYI's Education Desk, about CRT in Indiana. So, Eric, is CRT a curriculum that is being taught in Indiana schools? Let's just clarify this for our listeners.
Right.
You know, we
right.
keep hearing so many things.
Well, yeah, I think, you know, it's not a curriculum. And like I said, you know, previously, it's more of a framework for studying or, you know, kind of like analyzing different types of history and how people of color have been impacted by that. And so there isn't a curriculum, you know, that I'm aware of. You know, Indiana does not have that either approved as part of their state approved standards. And I'm not aware of any school district, you know, that teaches the CRT framework to its students. You know, I'm not saying that there is not any in the state. I'm not aware of any. And you are hearing a lot of school districts that are now coming out and announcing that they don't teach it. You know,
right.
I mentioned Hamilton County schools have all come out and said that. Indianapolis Public School District, which has taken kind of a public stance on being a anti-racist school district. Their leader came out recently, you know, and said that that is not part of their curriculum.
Is there a reason why it's being presented as this? I mean, it seems like there's a lot of misinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, it's become a catch-all phrase, and I think it's, you know, it's become more of a political issue than like an education policy issue. And I think that's why a lot of maybe education journalists, you know, across the country and maybe political reporters have struggled on how to like report on this. You know, we had Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita put out a document, you know, called the Parents' Bill of Rights that spends a lot of pages on CRT. And I think he adds a lot of terms, other terms into CRT as being related or part of it, like culturally responsive teaching. And I think that, you know, people hear that term, like a term like that used, you know, there's a number of charter schools, you know, that I know in Indianapolis that kind of use that as a kind of a framework for how they teach to their students. And I think that's kind of like misleading people into thinking that this is like kind of a curriculum plan that includes these different things that is being directly taught to students. When I think it's kind of, you know, CRT is more of, I think, a word now being used for an array of topics that mm-hmm. people are opposed to.
Mm-hmm. So it's just becoming this sort of phrase that's trying to give people panic in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, I think it becomes hard to have a conversation about it when I think there maybe is disagreement on what it means. You know, I mean, it has a definition, but then I think the way different people use the term, it leads to, you know, to just misinformation. And then it's hard to have, like, I think, a debate when people aren't using the same terms in the same way.
Right. And when it comes to students, has there been any conversation with them to hear about their thoughts about, you know, being taught from the framework of critical race theory?
Yeah, you know, I mean, right now I'm not really able to, you know, just kind of give my sense on like how students feel. You know, I've heard from parents, you know, who say their high schoolers are troubled, you know, by some of the more current event teaching going on in class about, you know, racism and its history in America. But going back to Hamilton County, you know, we've had students coming out who are, you know, kind of who are supporting the teaching of these topics, supporting the teaching of diversity and inclusion around that. So I think, you know, you probably have people on both sides, you know. I think it kind of, like any kind of political debate, you know, there's all kinds of ideas on it. But I think it goes back to, you know, what are we really debating over? I think is what Indiana is going to face very soon.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we wrap up here, I'm curious about teachers in Indiana, specifically like in public schools. How much choice do they have individually for what kind of curriculum they put together for the classroom? Or is there like a standard?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what you're hearing. I mean, that's what I've been hearing from parents who are upset about this. You know, they're wanting to know, like, they're asking, like, how does this work? And this is some basic information, which is great for everyone to know. You know, but the state law makes the State Board of Education responsible for the standards. And that's like the level of what a student should learn, attain in each subject and grade, right? So that's like, at what grade should you be learning certain topics of math, you know, or history. So how that's actually taught is the curriculum. And that's like the textbooks used and like what lessons are planned. And that's on the local school district level and the school boards, you know? And then you kind of get into like maybe a singular school, you know, maybe that the history teacher in a school is kind of designing the curriculum for multiple high school students or multiple high school classes while following those state standards. So it is going to look differently school to school, school district as they follow the state approved standards.
Thank you so much, Eric Weddle, managing editor for WFYI's Education Desk. If you have any questions or comments for the show, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Up next, we'll hear from Eric Harvey, an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan and the author of the upcoming book, Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. We're talking today about American culture in the late 80s and 1990s, particularly the emergence of raw, authentic rap music and the early days of reality television. We're joined by the author of an upcoming book on that very topic. Eric Harvey is an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. Eric, I want to ask you if you can give us a little bit of historical context. You can go back to the early 70s when rap music and hip hop culture started forming. Can you give us a little background on what that looked like?
Right. So if you look back at this moment, this was sort of the peak of the Black Power movement. When you think of the term soul, this was a moment when this idea was sort of congealing in Black communities and in popular culture together. And you know, this was, we all know the end of the 60s was a very, very heated time in terms of American politics and American cultural politics. And, you know, so you had the assassination of Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. Then you have the kind of, you know, around that same time, you know, you had the Watts uprising and similar uprisings around the country. And, you know, Black popular music was, you know, during the 60s, you had Motown and Stax, and you had a lot of kind of crossover Black popular music superstars. And a lot of these folks, you know, Marvin Gaye, Isaac Hayes, Curtis Mayfield, Aretha Franklin, and so on, Nina Simone, started incorporating kind of social commentary into their music. And so you get things like What's Going On and Superfly and albums like this. And At the same time, sort of a little bit more on the fringes, you had artists like Gil Scott-Heron out of New York City, who was a poet who started kind of setting some of this poetry to kind of very sparse production and eventually more jazz-leaning production. Gil Scott-Heron, who we know is responsible for the great phrase, the revolution will not be televised. And at the same time, you had the Watts Prophets, you had the Last Poets. A lot of these groups were really doing sort of oral poetry sort of to a beat and really laying the groundwork and talking about content-wise, like, what does it take? What will it take for African-Americans, for Black Americans to really kind of reach the status that they deserve in American society? It looks like the 60s have failed. You know, what's next? What can we do? And so music sort of became a platform for that. And this is right around the same time in the Bronx where, you know, DJs like Kool Herc were throwing their first block parties. You know, Kool Herc was not an expressly political guy. He was a DJ. You know, the roots of hip hop were kind of congealing there as well. And so really by the end of the 1970s, you had the full foundation, the full framework of what we would later call hip hop.
Mm-hmm. And you spoke a bit about gangster rap and how people were confusing, or at least the media was labeling it gangster rap. Is there a difference, or was that just the media term?
So it's interesting, right? So NWA, they both embraced the moniker and they kept it at an arm's distance. So, you know, NWA had a song called Gangsta, right? And this was a single that they released and they referred to themselves in their song called as a gang called We Know the Rest. And so they did that because, I mean, this plays into a lengthy history of rock and roll rebellion and popular music as sort of an outsider medium. And to be sure, NWA were total outsiders at the time that they broke through. This was not born in the center of the music industry. They were soon there, but they did it of their own volition. But the heart and soul behind NWA, for my money, is Ice Cube. Ice Cube, I think, is one of the most underrated, even though everybody knows his name today, I think he's one of the most underappreciated rappers to ever do it. And he was the brains, really, behind NWA. And he's the one who comes out and says, you know, it's about more than you know, sort of the vulgar street stuff. This is he referred to hip hop as a network of information. Which I think is a really interesting way of thinking about it. You know, this is how for rappers, he said, you know, rappers like Ice Cube, he says, oh, this is how I learn about what's going on with people like me in Houston through the Ghetto Boys. This is what I learn about what's going on with folks like me in New York, in Long Island, or in New York from Public Enemy and Eric B. and Rakim, rappers like that. And so Ice Cube kind of was doing with rap by merging entertainment and information. He was really kind of leading hip hop along with Chuck D and Ice-T. He was leading hip hop in the same direction that journalism itself was going, which was this merger of entertainment and information.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's important to note that, I mean, for folks who are listening, who may not remember these days, there was no cell phone and internet at this time. This seems like the most ingenious way to sort of have communication across the country.
Yeah, I feel like it, you know, when Chuck D said rap is Black America's TV station, right? And he said that in 1988. If he would have said that in 2008, you know, it would have been rap is, you know, Black America's social media, etc. But at the time, I think television was really this medium that had a powerful hold on the imagination in terms of what it could accomplish in bringing America together and presenting them information and kind of reaching a mass audience.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All in Vox Pop. Just search for All in Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it onto the show. We're speaking with Eric Harvey, an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan, who has an upcoming book about American culture in the late 80s and 90s when it comes to rap and reality television. Eric, when we talk about gangster rap or folks that wanted to label it as such, what was the music usually about?
Well, that's a great question. It's about a lot of stuff. And so there's the content that really sort of angered a lot of people and worried a lot of people was the stuff that dealt with sex and violence, which, you know, the rappers would say, look, this is the culture of the streets. This is the culture of, you know, for NWA and Ice-T, this is the culture of Black Los Angeles. You know, you made it, and now we're reflecting it back to you. You know, and so there's no denying that a lot of the content on these albums is what you would maybe call like the disreputable pleasure, right? Which is the same kind of pleasure, don't get me wrong, that you're getting by watching kind of tawdry, you know, Amy Fisher stories, Joey Buttafuoco, kind of at the similar time on you know, the national news networks. And so so yes, a lot of this content is profoundly misogynist. It's sort of, you know, lashing out at perceived enemies, which, you know, are kind of street rivals, police, and, you know, women who don't know their proper place, according to a lot of them. And so a lot of that stuff is prevalent. But there's what I would call a pedagogical aspect to this music too. There's so much to learn, you know, about Black popular culture and about Black history. I mean, you know, I write in the book a little bit about how, in the preface about how I learned that, you know, this was where I learned about, you know, hip hop records were where I learned about the Black Panthers. It was where I learned about who Marcus Garvey was. It made me, you know, I had to go to the library at the time and look up what COINTELPRO was, because I was, you know, hearing about this stuff on these albums. And so it was this, that was the other kind of part of this music, you know. So when you listen to, especially Ice Cube's solo albums, you listen to Public Enemy's albums, I mean, Public Enemy, this is, you know, one of the big reasons why Louis Farrakhan became such a prominent figure to a generation of young people was Chuck D from Public Enemy was putting him on Public Enemy records. And so, yeah, it was this sort of mixture of you know, the kind of prurient content mixed with sort of righteous indignation and a little bit of history that none of us were getting in schools at the time, like far from it.
So it was keeping it real before these changes in education, where they're like, we're actually going to start teaching you guys what really happened.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Totally.
Well, when it comes to the different roles that early 90s rap music played, what was it like for the Black community at that time? Was this a way to, again, get the voices out there?
Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm, of course, you know, full disclosure, you know, I'm speaking about this music as an eavesdropper. I grew up, you know, in the suburbs of Indianapolis, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And so I can't, you know, directly speak, you know, to the Black community's experience, but just reading, you know, writing this book, I was reading, I read all the biographies that are available about these rappers, and I kind of dove into the literature. And again, I you know, I do think that it served, I mean, it was a massive entertainment product. It kind of reorganized the music industry in a lot of important ways. But it was also an important network of information, especially for African Americans who were for decades shut out of major media coverage, who had problems with the police, who had problems with redlining and you know, so many other economic problems that you know, this was one pipeline. This was a way to kind of get their voices heard.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, I do want to take a look at an example, or a listen, I should say, of a time when hip-hop culture and reality TV came together in a literal sense. A panel of musicians and social commentators appeared in a 1990 episode of The Oprah Winfrey Show to talk about controversial lyrics and imagery in popular rap and punk music. You highlight this episode in your book, and we're going to listen to a couple of clips from the show. First, here's Juan Williams, writer for The Washington Post. Let's take a listen.
The way we do music today, especially with Walkmans, as you said, as you started the show, a lot of times parents aren't aware what the kids are listening to. The kids are listening, tuned into certain things, hearing these lyrics, responding to them, thinking of them as really anthems for their generation and their sort of rebellion, and tapping into all the hatred and resentments these kids have. And that's the way the music industry today seems to be feeding off of it, making money off of those instincts, rather than, if you think back to the 60s, the instincts about peace, love, and live together.
Eric, is this a common kind of commentary artists were getting at the time?
Yeah, I think, you know, Juan Williams was coming from a perspective when he was kind of looking at an era, you know, the late 60s, as I was kind of talking about earlier, when music was engaging with social realities in a way that was, you know, at times, you know, deeply resonant, but it was also kind of safe for airplay. And yeah, I mean, you know, if you grew up in the 60s and you were of a certain, I mean, by the way, all these rappers who I talk about in the book were either born in the 60s or very early 70s. And so these folks grew up kind of after the civil rights era in the 70s when things were a lot more muddled in terms of kind of, you know, where the where Black America was headed. And yeah, I mean, there's, you know, in a real sense, you know, you have somebody like Juan Williams, who's sort of a moderate political commentator, still around, who was at Fox News for a while. You know, of course, they're going to look at something like Ice-T. I mean, Ice-T had just released his album, The Iceberg, right before this episode aired. And oh, yeah, this was one of the most vulgar albums to ever see wide release. And so they dialed in not on the content, not on the kind of cultural context that kind of spurs this music, but they dialed in specifically just on like the bad words.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, another guest on this episode of Oprah was one of the originators of West Coast gangsta rap, Ice-T, as you mentioned. Here's what he had to say in response to Juan and to the critics of his lyrics. Let's take a listen.
Don, I don't have evil intent. I just make records in the format that, you know, me and my homeboys talk, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I mean, what I say on that record, which you heard, I didn't hear anything different than that in the movie Harlem Nights or anything. What I do is I bring out how brothers on the corner talk. Now, I might be wrong, but I can't talk any other way than I know how to talk. If I had to grow up like Brian Gumbel, I'd rap like Brian Gumbel.
So what does this argument from Ice-T tell us about the cultural dividing point you're looking into?
So I think that when you talk about, and Ice-T was really one of the earliest people, he's written about this several times, and he's written a couple of books, and where he's a big proponent of the phrase reality rap. And he actually says he uses the phrase faction as well, too, to blend fact and fiction, which is a little bit harder to it's got some synonyms. But anyway, he is a big proponent of saying, look, there is as small of a barrier as possible between what I put on wax, what I'm recording in the studio, and what I am either overhearing or talking about with my friends when we're hanging out. And this is really the same promise that is made by documentary filmmakers. This is the same promise that is made by the kind of local news outlets who say live, local, late breaking. And, you know, stands a reporter in front of, you know, some kind of event that's happening, is you're getting sort of the vox populi. You're getting the voice of the street, but not the voice of the street that the kind of mainstream news wants you to hear, but the voice that you're never going to hear unless you kind of take a trip to these neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm. And that's interesting that he's mentioning that. And I'm surprised, like, this was from so long ago that they're speaking like this and come to today. And I feel like there's been a little bit more leeway in some of the lyrics and popular music and even movies and things like that. But Ice-T mentions a movie in that clip. And it's an argument that's often come up. Harsh language and imagery has long been accepted and even celebrated in movies, but is criticized when it shows up in music.
Right. Yeah. 1990 was a huge moment for this, too, which is when this episode aired. 1990 was the year that the MPAA changed the X rating to NC-17 because X was just, you know, impossible to release a movie. So NC-17 felt a little softer. So a lot of people were dealing with sort of the role of obscenity and vulgarity in American society at this moment. Some of your listeners may remember this was the big Robert Mapplethorpe moral panic. Robert Mapplethorpe was displaying some photographs at a gallery in Cincinnati, and that kind of erupted into this kind of moral panic about art and obscenity. This was the heyday of comedians like Andrew Dice Clay, you know, proudly vulgar, not censored at all to the extent that rappers were. You know, this was really the moment, you know, it was kind of America's existential foes had been vanquished, quote unquote, with the fall of communism. And it really felt for a whole decade that America was kind of turning on itself and fighting with itself, and vulgarity and obscenity and all of these moral panics really kind of rose to the forefront.
Thank you so much. That was Eric Harvey, an Indiana native who's now an associate professor at Grand Valley State University in Michigan and author of the upcoming book, Who Got the Camera? A History of Rap and Reality, which comes out this fall. If you have any questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Up next, with billionaires heading up to space, is the commercialization of space travel around the corner? We'll find out. I'm Miriam Sobe, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Space tourism has become a hot topic, with billionaires like Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos traveling past the stratosphere. But how accessible will space travel be, and is it good for the planet? To talk about it, we're joined by Barrett Caldwell, the director of the NASA Indiana Space Grant Consortium and professor of industrial engineering at Purdue University. Welcome to the program, Barrett. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Before we get started, can we just define what is space tourism?
Wow. Several people have tried to come up with a specific definition. I would say space tourism is really the opportunity for someone to go above the various lines that we demarcate as the start of space for enjoyment or recreation rather than for science or engineering work or for exploration.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, as I asked you that, I started thinking about how we keep talking about these billionaires going up into space, but they didn't really go to space, did they? I mean, they didn't go to the moon.
No, but the idea of going to space is basically going through enough of the Earth's atmosphere to a certain altitude. If you look at the history of NASA, DOD, American efforts, that's been listed as an altitude of 50 miles. There is a scientific line called the Kármán line, which is based on how much atmosphere there is left, and that will vary between roughly 50 and maybe 65 or 70 miles.
So they
call it 100 kilometers or 62 miles because of the international standard.
Mm-hmm. And is that when you reach weightlessness? Is that when you know you're in space?
No, weightlessness is a really different idea. It's when you are falling as fast as the pull of gravity is exerting, so that even if you're in a vehicle that's orbiting the Earth, the idea of orbit is that you're falling towards the Earth, but by the time you move a certain distance, the vehicle has moved a certain distance as well, so you haven't changed your position. So weightlessness is really a matter of acceleration. It's not really a matter of altitude.
Interesting. Well, why do you think more private companies and billionaires are getting involved in this industry?
Well, I think that if they are anything like me, for instance, I grew up as a child of the Apollo space flights. I was riveted in front of television for Apollo 8 and for Apollo 11. And I said, that's what I want to do with myself. I think there are a lot of people who've been inspired by space and have been inspired by the history of exploration. And I guess the difference when you have a 9 or 10 figure bank account is that you can actually make decisions to start supporting that spirit of exploration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's nice to be a billionaire. You can do whatever you want.
Well, I used to think so. And then I had my financial advisor explain to me all the other things that I would have to do. And when I managed my lab of about 5 or 6 students, and then I realized what I would have to do if I had to manage 50 or 60,000 people as the head of a company, suddenly it doesn't look so good to me anymore.
Right. Well, what role are local space experts playing in this field of space tourism, if any at all?
Well, there's a lot. There's, you know, a lot of discussion about how much this billionaire or that billionaire spent. But really, it's not like Elon or Jeff or Richard was hiding out in their basement by themselves, stealing aluminum off of somebody's loading dock. They're heads of companies. And in those companies, there are engineers, there are scientists, there are technicians who have been doing this work. And when those vehicles go and leave the Earth's surface, they're often carrying engineering experiments, scientific experiments that help us understand what is the capability for future spaceflight. Mm-hmm. So we have had Stephen Colicott, one of my colleagues here at Purdue, actually wasn't going to be able to join us this week because he's out doing research projects that look at what we call payload experiments, scientific research that can be done only or best in the realm of microgravity. One of the two crew members on the Virgin Galactic flight is a student, Sarisha Benlith, that I remember as an undergraduate. And she was as inspired by spaceflight as I was, hoping for the opportunity. Now she and Beth, another Purdue alumna, they've gone to space. They have their wings. And I think that those two, Wally Funk, are also going to be inspirations to other people in the future.
Mm-hmm. You know, I honestly didn't realize Purdue has such a big role with a lot of the space exploration stuff that goes on.
Yeah, we are very proud of having two things. One, lots of basketball championships, and the other one is having lots of astronauts. Mm-hmm. And, if we now talk about NASA astronauts as well as commercial astronauts, we're at 26, I think, now, which is clearly the most among any public university. And that is one of the things that we're very proud of. Indiana as a whole has had a long history in the space program. Obviously, if you talk about Gus Grissom, an Indiana native, we have a number of other natives, Ken Bowersox and Charlie Walker, from that one county, Lawrence County in southern Indiana. But we also have companies that have been involved in the history of spaceflight, Alcoa, ITT. Those are names that you may not hear much anymore because they've changed their names, but they were there during the Apollo era. We've had payload research teams, Tech Shot now, started as a Purdue undergraduate science experiment. We've got high altitude and CubeSat launch capabilities that have been developed in the state of Indiana. Actually, we've got a company in Upland that Near Space Launch, that's part of our Space Grant Consortium. They are good at assembling and integrating CubeSats, and they've done so for Taylor University and for the University of Southern Indiana, that both have put CubeSats into orbit. And the, not Indiana State, University of Southern Indiana. And the University of Southern Indiana CubeSat is actually still in orbit as we speak.
Oh, that's fascinating. And you mentioned the Space Grant Consortium, the NASA Indiana Space Grant Consortium. What exactly is this program?
This is a program that is supported by the NASA Office of STEM Engagement. And there is a Space Grant Consortium in each of the 50 states, as well as the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico. They're standing up two more in Guam and the Virgin Islands. And the idea is to be a source of education and inspiration, but also a source of workforce development at the college level for students with an interest in engineering and science, for faculty that are developing new research programs, everything from agricultural monitoring to zoology. Are STEM fields that are supported by NASA because they are part of NASA's mission and NASA's emphasis on understanding the planet better and increasing the capability for engineering and scientific exploration.
Mm-hmm. Well, when it comes to going back to sort of the space tourism stuff, are there any purists in the space industry that think that this is over the top?
I'm not really one to say that I've met many of those people. I think that, the people that I know are hardcore NASA people. They're thrilled for the opportunity to have more companies, more engineering designs, more opportunities to launch payloads, to get people to the space station, to help build the Artemis Gateway in cislunar space. The idea that this is only something to be done by a national government, I think that era is in many ways glad to be over, because it means that we're not just looking to a single organization or a single supply chain to do this work. I see people that are cheering just as hard for Blue Origin or SpaceX or Virgin Galactic as the latest NASA launch.
Mm-hmm. Well, how accessible is, and I keep saying space tourism, I don't know if there's a better word for it, but how accessible is it for folks to go up past the stratosphere right now?
Well, I think, if you look at the ticket prices, there's a challenge of, will there be enough seats for the people who want to go, is actually the bigger problem. I think it's about $250,000 for a seat. If I look at that, that's probably the cost of an RV. Mm-hmm. And so I think there are a lot of people who would have the capability for it. Clearly, there are lots of people that have that much in their 401k. I won't say that's a majority of the population. Maybe it's 5 or 10% of the population. But we're not talking about the tens of millions, maybe up to 100 million that people had paid for the opportunity to travel to the space station.
Mm. And that makes me wonder, though, the next step. I mean, there's this going up as far and as high as you can. Will there be a time when people can actually go and land on the moon, for example? I just think of the moon because, as a child, those were the stories that we heard about that first step on the moon. Are we ever going to see that again?
That's a difficult question. I think about the Stanley Kubrick movie, 2001. And the idea of the Hilton Hotel in space station and the lunar visits. Let's be clear, getting to the moon is actually quite hard. And to say that we are going to have thousands of people doing that just for fun, I don't see that happening in mm-hmm. the next 20 years. I don't see it, even if I had a longer lifespan than that, happening in my lifespan, because we've had only about a dozen people that have been able to see the Earth from the lunar surface.
Mm-hmm.
And the last time we did that was nearly 50 years ago. So to say we're going to go from 12 to 100 to 1,000 in the next 10 or 15 years, The engineering just doesn't support it. We don't have that level of capability. And the one other thing I have to say, these are experiments. These are test flights. This is not like going down to your favorite tropical island on an airplane with tens of millions of flight hours of prior experience.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. And what are there when it comes to drawbacks, I guess, of doing space tourism, of even if it's, let's say, this $250K for a seat and there's enough people that'll be able to go back and forth. Is this good for the environment in the long run?
Is it good for the environment? There's lots of interesting questions there. If you look at particular types of launch fuels, like kerosene, that's probably not the most environmentally friendly of fuels. But I would say that our Jet A fuel that we all have been used to using and are going back to as travel opens up again, Jet A fuel is not environmentally friendly. And the idea to go to low lead aircraft fuel is probably a much higher priority in terms of net impact on the planet. There are fuels, actually one that was developed by some researchers now at Purdue. It's a combination of aluminum and liquid ice, or liquid water turned into ice, called ALICE. For the aluminum ice mixture is probably a lot more environmentally friendly. And what you would see with some of these corporate experiments is more people testing more environmentally friendly fuels, more environmentally friendly construction or orbit management techniques. And mm-hmm. That's what we always see, is that when there is one of those additional pressures, we see that through combinations of public-private or government-industry partnerships to say, let's see if that can work.
Right, right. Well, as we get ready to wrap up here in a couple of moments, is there anything interesting coming up in the space industry that you're looking forward to, excited to see?
Oh, there are so many things. In some ways, no, I'm not upset that I'm not 30 years younger, because I did get to see the Apollo missions. But there's a lot of excitement about the Artemis program, the idea of having a gateway, another station that's closer to lunar orbit. That's really, really exciting. As NASA says, putting the first woman and next man on the moon, chances are good that one of those people might be a Purdue astronaut. Just had to throw that in there. But we're talking about the gateway construction, cislunar supply chains, testing all those engineering capabilities, bringing the SLS online, having these corporate participants. These are things that are going to happen in the 2020s. And that's really, really exciting.
And do you think, you mentioned that the next woman and man to go to the moon, do you think that's something we will see?
I think the designs are there. The commitment and the enthusiasm is there. I don't want to get into the politics of funding, but I think the ability to complete the engineering loops to get astronauts to the lunar surface again, no later than 26 or 27, possibly by 24 or 25. Yeah, I think it's eminently doable.
Awesome. Well, I'll definitely be looking forward to that. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Barrett Caldwell is the director of the NASA Indiana Space Grant Consortium and a professor of industrial engineering at Purdue University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Miriam Soeb. Thanks for listening. This is All In.